Before starting today's interview, I would like to apologize for the poor sound quality. I spent considerable time editing the audio to make it the best it could be, but sometimes the connection is not as good as I would like. I am taking steps to continually improve the sound quality, but today's episode falls short of my standards. I'm sorry. Hello, thank you for joining me for episode 11 of the Sleep to Healthy podcast titled Sleeping Pills. I'm Dennis Trumpy, and my goal is to help improve your sleep for your better health and well-being. Humans have been trying to improve their sleep with sleeping aids for thousands of years. It's only natural to seek out solutions to insomnia. It's unpleasant laying awake for hours, and the daytime consequences can be equally undesirable. The wish for an instant, convenient, effortless, effective solution to our sleeping problems is enticing, but not necessarily the right answer or achievable. Sleeping pills have been with us for decades, and recent advances have seen new medicines that are more targeted for specific sleep issues, and equally importantly, less detrimental during our wakeful hours. But what are reasonable expectations for these pills? When deciding if sleeping pills are appropriate, many factors need to be considered, such as the root cause of the problem being solved. For instance, is the sleep issue caused by stress, or is there a biological basis? Also, interactions with other medicines, or herbal products, or even supplements. Relevant medical issues such as weakened kidney function or sleep apnea. How long the chemicals stay in our system and its impact during the daytime. What other issues the person is dealing with and how urgently the intervention is needed. And which non-medical interventions are also appropriate. All this means that it is in your best interest to be well educated when you think about taking a sleeping aid to help with your sleep problems. The issue isn't whether sleeping pills and their cousins are good or bad, but whether medication is appropriate, and if so, which one. Uneducated choices can prove problematic, such as using a sleep medication that suppresses breathing when you already suffer from sleep apnea. Fortunately, today we have the person who wrote the book on sleeping pills, Dr. Wallace Mendelson, who recently wrote the book Understanding Sleeping Pills. He is a retired professor of psychiatry and clinical pharmacology at the University of Chicago. Dr. Mendelson's credentials are too numerous to list here, but include being the director at the Sleep Disorders Center at the Cleveland Clinic, publishing over 190 peer-reviewed papers, and is the past president of the Sleep Research Society. In his book, in addition to sleeping pills, Dr. Mendelson covers other treatments for insomnia, such as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and he covers non-prescription sleep aids. Dr. Mendelson, welcome to this episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to chatting with you today.
You are retired now, but during your career, you regularly witnessed people improve their sleep. Can you give us an example where someone really struggled with getting a good night's sleep, but was able to work their way out of it?
Well, sure. Certainly one person who comes to my mind is a 55-year-old engineer, as I recall. He described having trouble sleeping for about 10 years, five or six nights a week. He said that mostly it was difficulty going off to sleep, and he would lie in bed feeling like his thoughts were racing and couldn't settle down. He would also say that sometimes he would start thinking about issues he would have to deal with the next day and would sort of either planning out, you know, how to manage them. He also would when he did finally go to sleep, would sometimes wake up briefly during the last half of the night, and the end result was that when he got up in the morning, that he did not feel rested. He felt fatigued. He would go to work, and he noted that at work he was less enthusiastic than he used to be. He thought his memory was poorer than it had been in the past. He told me a little bit about his life, which to me is very important, and not just to focus on the sleep. And among the things I learned is that he was unhappily married, and there was some tension with his wife regarding her mother, who she wished to have move in with them, and he didn't want that. And this was something that was going on right now, and he thought might be contributing to his difficulties. He had tried taking over-the-counter sleeping pills in the past, I should say sleep aids in the past, and they didn't really seem to help. He also mentioned that sometimes he would take a drink of wine bedtime to help him sleep. I talked to him at length, and we went through another number of steps, the first of which was to look whether there were any illnesses that he might have that might be causing his sleep difficulty. They did not seem to be, but that's probably the first thing one should think about. We looked, as you had mentioned earlier, other medicines he's taking, because sometimes medicines given just for a variety of medical illnesses can be causing trouble sleep. There we noticed that he was on some decongestants chronically, which can disturb sleep, and I suggested that he talk with his doctor about alternative types of medicines. He was also receiving thyroid medicine, and we arranged to get a blood test, because in excess, they too can cause trouble sleeping, although, of course, they're very important and just need to be given in the correct amounts. We thought about psychiatric illnesses that might be present that might be related to poor sleep, and didn't see any obvious ones. Although he felt a little bit depressed, he didn't appear to have major depressive illness and so on. So the question then became what to do about his difficulties. I suggested that he consider the non-medicine approach, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which we'll call CBTI as we keep talking today. He was kind of skeptical about it, saying that he wanted action quickly, and that he was skeptical about therapy, which he thought might take a long time. I explained to him that this is actually usually a short thing lasting 2 or 3 months, often involving 6 or 8 visits. It's not an open-ended, long-term kind of thing. He was still somewhat skeptical, and so we made a kind of compromise, which I often do, and I think is a very good one, and that is to combine CBT with medication to get the benefit of medicines relatively quickly while working on the longer-term efforts for dealing with this problem with CBT. We did this, and obviously we're not always successful, but in this case, he felt relief right away from the hypnotic, and that made him more enthusiastic and willing to work with CBT for a long-term effort.
Well, when you started off that description, I thought you were describing me. As I was an engineer, I used to have the racing thoughts and trying to solve problems and waking up through the night. So I'm glad you went on and realized that wasn't me you're talking about. One unique aspect of your book is that it contains illustrations of artwork about sleep from various cultures and periods in history and different perspectives. What inspired you to include sleep art in a book on sleeping pills?
Well, you're correct. I have a lot of pictures taken from great artwork over the centuries. And the reason is that although I'm a scientist and very committed to the scientific approach, sometimes it's very difficult in objective language to describe the feelings and the emotions that are involved in sleep. And sometimes this can be expressed better with the arts, and I've tried to do that. There's also been a fascination for centuries, as you've pointed out, with medicines that, or substances, let us say, that can help put a person to sleep. And tried to reflect that by showing, for instance, pictures of night and sleep, two goddesses flying through the air, distributing herbs to aid sleep onto the population as night goes on. In another case, we have a picture from Wagner's, an illustration of Wagner's Valkyrie, in which Siegfried puts a sleeping draught in her husband's drink because she would prefer that he be asleep for several hours for reasons of her own. So I think art can very often express things that are very difficult to say just in scientific language, and I'm hoping that my book will try to find a medium between both techniques.
Well, for me, it worked. I found that the artwork kind of complemented the kind of hard technical nature of some parts of the book. It was like a bit of fresh air when you'd come across some nice art after you'd slogged through a few pages of technical terms and so on. And even this podcast, I mean, our main focus is on the scientific, but I also try to bring in people from other perspectives, whether it's something like yoga or dreams, to give a little bit of a rounded off approach to sleep. I think it would be good to start this discussion from kind of a broad perspective and then to work our way down to specifics. You've been involved and passionate about sleep research for many years, some of it groundbreaking, and you continue to be active in promoting good sleep even in your retirement. Why is it so important to you that people become educated about sleep and tackle their insomnia?
Well, I think one important reason is that I've come to realize over the years that insomnia is not just a problem of lying in bed suffering because you're unable to sleep. It's really a problem that affects a person 24 hours a day. And I suspect we'll get into that later, but there are many kinds of studies that show that people with insomnia are more prone to having accidents, they don't do as well as work, they don't do as well in their interpersonal lives, and so on. So it's something that affects you awake or asleep. And I think the next point about it is that it's not hopeless. There are a lot of things that one can do about it. And my goal in writing this book and some other related books is that people understand that it is not hopeless, and in fact, there are a lot of treatment options out there.
You are probably like me, and many others. You make your decisions based on reviews. Help others discover this podcast by leaving a review on your favorite podcast app or Apple Podcasts. Others who are struggling with sleep will thank you. Visit sleeptohealthy.com if you're not sure how. In your book's description of the pharmaceuticals used in sleeping pills, it astonished me how the chemical's function is understood with such precision, you know, down to specific functional sites on a neuron's cell walls. Some people are concerned about risks or side effects of using sleeping pills. What would you say to those people?
Well, I would say that sleeping pills indeed, like any kinds of medicines, have benefits and they also have risks. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book is that people should be aware of both and then make a choice weighing the benefits and the risks to choose the right medicine. The broader way I would say it is you shouldn't be a passive recipient of a treatment for insomnia or a treatment for anything else. You should be an equal partner with your doctor in making choices about your care. And to be an effective equal partner, you have to have the knowledge that you need to make these decisions. And my goal is to help provide that knowledge in a way that's understandable to everyone. Let me add one other point. We're talking about risks of sleeping pills, and I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about that later. But let me just point out, you also have to think about what are the risks of not treating insomnia. And so folks with insomnia have all sorts of difficulties with their lives, as we just mentioned. There's also issues with health and so on. So you also have to weigh the risks of not treating it properly.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I found the book, you know, is quite broad in scope, and yet it's also very specific. I thought it gives a good overview of sleeping pill in relationship to other alternatives, but also if you're thinking about a specific medication, you really drill down to the specifics about it and the other one so you can compare one to another as well and try to understand what the trade-offs might be. We live in an increasingly self-help, self-taught society. You know, as an example, in addition to enrolling in a podcasting school, I myself learned much about podcasting from internet searches, YouTube videos, books, blogs. This habit of doing it yourself spills over into our desire to fix our sleeping issues by similar means. What would you like people to know who are trying to solve their sleeping issues on their own?
Well, I think the first thing is understanding what insomnia is, what its consequences can be, and what treatments are out there for one to choose. So I think learning about the available treatments on your own is a very important step before seeking help. Now, if you truly mean on your own without having help, it's difficult for me to say. I take the view that an important part is working with a caregiver who can look with things like possible effects of other illnesses or medicines, possible presence of psychiatric illness and so on, which really need to be done by somebody else. So it's a little hard for me to answer that. But one I would mention is there are some online cognitive behavioral therapy programs that one can do online. There's still a matter of study whether they're as effective as seeing a therapist. And I think the jury isn't in on that. One paper I saw recently said that in many cases it could be a very useful thing to do the online CBTI, but that some groups don't seem to work as well. And one example turned out to be in the elderly, for instance. Other people argue that maybe there's a balance in between, that one, instead of going to a therapist for a complete course of CBTI, one can do these kinds of automated programs with a limited number of visits with a professional. So we still don't really know the answer out, but there are some CBTI online programs one can try.
Yeah, I think in a lot of different aspects of life, combining efforts or methodologies is better than any one in particular. I was thinking that, you know, you mentioned about sleeping pills combined with CBTI can be an effective solution. And in this case, you know, finding out information on your own, but also getting professional help to help zero in on the right solution is probably a good approach. Due to various reasons, our visits with our doctors are often short. Our time to present our condition accurately and helpfully, and the time the healthcare professional has to probe and be thorough is limited. What advice do you have for someone who is going to their doctor or sleep specialist to find a solution to their sleep issues?
Well, this is, of course, a very real issue, is that face-to-face time with doctors is often limited, and is something that I think we as a society are struggling with to find ways to deal with this. But certainly one step one can do is to come prepared. My book, Understanding Sleeping Pills, is one way that I personally have made an effort to help a person maximize the time with their doctor by already having an understanding both of the disorder and of the benefits and risks of different treatments. So certainly the bottom line is prepare, prepare, prepare.
And are there kind of specific areas of your life that you should focus in, lifestyle or other medications? Like, are there certain things that a person could make sure that they include in that visit?
Well, certainly a very important one is an accurate list of medications that you're taking to show the doctor, and also to include on that over-the-counter medicines given for any purpose. Just to give you an example, a lot of over-the-counter medicines for a variety of purposes can contain caffeine without a person realizing it. They can have more caffeine intake than they think they do. Another one is to be very honest and forthright about the amount of alcohol one consumes. You know, there's a tendency to sort of minimize alcohol consumption when talking to the doctor. It's very important to be straightforward about that for two reasons. One is that, of course, if you're dependent on alcohol, that itself will produce very significant long-term sleep disturbance. And the second is, even in a person who's not abusing alcohol, who just takes a moderate drink, alcohol actually can disturb sleep. I suspect we'll talk about that later at some point, but drinking alcohol in the evening very often can cause awakenings during the second half of the night.
When I was reading the book, I was kind of expecting a book lobbying the virtues of pharmaceutical interventions, but I found that was not the case. The book simply presents facts about the workings, pros and cons, and considerations that need to be heeded. What is the main message you're delivering about sleeping pills in the book?
Well, I think the main message in the book, Understanding Sleeping Pills, is to emphasize that, first of all, that they are only one of several kinds of treatment, and that the first decision one has to make is whether to go the route of medications or of talking therapies, or to consider a combination of the two. And the second, I think, message is to have an appreciation of why insomnia needs to be treated. That untreated insomnia has a number of consequences on one's life and health. And finally, that if you do go the route of medicines, that it's important to have realistic expectations and to understand both the benefits and the side effects that they might have, so that you can make an informed choice about them.
And you mention in the book that studies can indicate the response of a group to a medication, but that does not mean that the group's response will apply to an individual. There's a good chance that our personal response to a particular sleeping pill will be different than the average of the group. Can you talk a bit about what to do if the medication doesn't seem to be working?
Well, yes. In Understanding Sleeping Pills, I in fact have a chapter devoted to the topic of sleeping pill isn't working. And the main point, I think, is that one that you've already said, that scientific studies of sleeping pills applied to groups of people that were all individuals. So even though most people may respond to a particular medicine, it doesn't necessarily mean that you will. The wisest thing to do if the medicine doesn't seem to be working is to use it as an opportunity to go back to the very beginning, make sure that we haven't missed something in the kinds of things that we've talked about, for instance, the effects of other kinds of medicines or whether hidden depression is there. Depression is a very subtle thing, and it's not always easily recognizable. And it may be wise at that point for you and your doctor to go back and review that possibility. If it turns out that you are depressed, it's very important to treat it with treatments for depression. Sleeping pills by themselves do not treat depression. In fact, in some cases, can make it a little worse if given by themselves. The correct treatment is antidepressants or psychotherapies that are designed for depression. Now, if a person does have depression and they're receiving antidepressants, there is some data to suggest that adding a sleeping pill can be very helpful. But sleeping pills purely by themselves are not a solution in folks with depression. So going back to the beginning and considering things is important. I guess another example in the patient example that I used, I mentioned that this gentleman was in the middle of a conflict with his wife. Well, you know, there's no way you're going to sleep well if lying right beside you is a person with whom you have a lot of hostile feelings. So certainly an important part about insomnia is not just giving a person medicine, it's considering their whole life. In this case, my own guess is that all the medicines and so on may help. It's truly not going to sleep better until you address the issue of unhappy relationship with one's spouse. So these are the kind of things to do if a sleeping pill isn't working. It's a very good opportunity to go back to the very beginning and make sure that one hasn't missed something. And so again, you ought to think about what medicines you're taking and whether one of them may be disturbing sleep. Another, think about what other illnesses one has which might be preventing sleep. For instance, if somebody is in pain for whatever reason, it may be that seeing your doctor about managing pain may be an important part of dealing with your sleep. Just to use one example, again, to think about depression. Depression can be a very subtle thing. It's not immediately obvious to the person who's suffering it. If you've gone back through all these kinds of things and you're back where you were, they, certainly one can consider using a different medication. It usually is not wise to increase the dose of the present medicine. In most cases, increasing dosages just leads to more side effects with very minimal greater improvement in sleep. If you do go to a second medicine, the thing that's important to remember is that it's a very unlikely to be a magical answer. Any improvements you have are likely to be incremental in nature. It's also maybe a time to think about whether sleeping pills are the right route for you or whether it might be wise to consider the addition of non-medicine talking therapies such as CBTI.
One of the key goals of this podcast is to change people's lives for the better. We can have great guests with mesmerizing interviews, listened to by thousands of people. But if people's lives are not improving, then this podcast has been for naught. Your sleep success can inspire others to make changes for the better. If there's something you heard on this podcast that resulted in a positive change in your sleep and in your life, drop me a line and let me know. You can record your story on your smartphone and send the file to dennis@sleeptohealthy.com or go to sleeptohealthy.com for several other ways to connect with me, such as leaving a voice message, texting, or emailing. However, I do prefer to hear your voice. I will share these stories on future episodes. The story of your success could make a huge difference to other people's lives, probably more than anything that I could say or do. So, on behalf of my grateful listeners, thank you for being courageous and taking the time to tell us about your sleep success. And how common is it to have to try a few different medications before you zero in on one that is effective for you?
Well, I think it's a fairly common thing. I try to use the example that in some ways the experience with sleeping pills are similar to the experience with antidepressants. And what I mean by that is if you're a psychiatrist treating a person with major depression, the first dose of the first sleeping pill will probably only really be effective in, let us say, 40 to 60% of folks. And if you're part of that other group, there are several medication choices, but one may be to try another medicine. And if you do that, then the likelihood that you'll get better increases somewhat. If you go to a third medicine, it increases somewhat more, and ultimately you get up to numbers like, let us say, 80, 90% effectiveness. And I don't think anybody's ever done precise numbers in that manner with insomnia, but it sort of fits my experience.
And in your opinion, do you think too many people or do people give up prematurely before they've given sleeping pills a fair chance?
It's important to know that you have to work with a doctor in a process that may take some time and that patience is very much the key to the whole thing. The other part, you know, a lot of folks come to realize, but only over time, is that their insomnia is very often related to their lives. A lot of folks, you know, have sort of a feeling that the insomnia is just something that happened to them, that it's not related to difficulties they may be having. It's not necessarily related to their behaviors and so on. And it's only after talking with the caregiver for some time that you begin to see that there may be other things going on. I guess one example that I used in my description of a patient at the beginning was, he was in the middle of a conflict with his wife about his mother-in-law. Well, it's very hard to have a good restful sleep when you're lying in bed right next to a spouse with whom you're in the middle of a conflict. And very often, all those sleeping pills and so on may be of some help. Probably, ultimately, to really sleep better, you have to address not only medicines, but also address things in your life that may be leading you to have disturbed sleep.
We live in a society where we expect instant and effective solutions to our problems. We want to be entertained, so we expect to be able to select from tens of thousands of on-demand movies and TV shows. We're bored. We expect to be able to get anywhere in the globe within 24 hours and experience something exciting and new. But our complex body and mind are not like that. What are some reasonable expectations around sleeping pills?
Well, I think it's important not to go into treatment with the expectation that there will be instant 100% success. I wish that were the case, but it often is not. Very often people will come to me who have had difficulty sleeping for 10, 15, 20 years, let's say. If you think about it, the course of wish is there that it will be instantly better. But if you sort of step back from it and think, if this has gone on for 20 years, you really think that suddenly in the next few days, everything is going to be better. And that's not truly a realistic expectation. Now, what is a realistic expectation is that if you work with a caregiver and you have patience, and you're willing to think about things you may not have thought about before and work on them, chances are very, very good that you're going to sleep a lot better in the long term. But it's not often an instant gratification thing.
And we talked earlier about self-medicating or finding your own solutions and some of the non-prescription choices available. What do you want us to know about over-the-counter sleeping medications?
Well, that's a very important thing. And certainly taking over-the-counter or OTC sleep aids appeals to the part of a person who wants to be independent and do it on his or her own. And I understand that appeal. The problem is virtually all of the things that are available over-the-counter are not so effective and, in fact, may have their own range of risks. A lot of folks believe that, well, if it's sold without a prescription, it may or may not help, but it must be safer. And that's actually not entirely true. The most common ingredient in over-the-counter sleep aids is an antihistamine called diphenhydramine. It was developed back in the 1940s for allergies, and in subsequent years, it's become very widely used over-the-counter for as a sleep aid. Well, the thing that we've learned over time is that, A, it's not necessarily very effective to help sleep at night. It certainly can make you sleepy in the daytime, but that's a different topic than the topic of if you take it at bedtime, will it help you sleep better? There's even some data that it can disturb sleep in a number of people. So not very effective. And the second point is it has its own range of side effects. In addition to daytime sleepiness, there's growing concern now that folks who take antihistamines nightly for very long periods of time, and I'm talking years here, not a few days, may have a higher risk of developing dementia when they're old. In addition, when antihistamines like diphenhydramine are taken by very old people, there's a risk that it can cause confusional states and delirium, which is a very serious thing. In medicine, there's a well-known list of drugs to be avoided in the elderly. It's called the Beers List, named after Dr. Beers, who first developed it. and antihistamines sit very prominently on that list. I should say diphenhydramine sits very prominently on that list. So over-the-counter sleep aids with diphenhydramine, by far the most common one, are not a very good choice for treating insomnia.
One of the persistent themes running throughout the book is the warning to avoid taking alcohol when on sleeping pills. What is it about alcohol that's so detrimental when mixed with sleeping pills?
Well, both alcohol and most sleeping pills are nervous system depressant. And when you combine the two, the degree of nervous system depression can get way out of hand and can have very deleterious effects. So it's very important, as you say, not to combine alcohol with sleeping pills under any circumstances.
And how, severe can the effects of combining them be?
Well, they can be very, very severe. Certainly, if one has sleep apnea disorder of having difficulty breathing during sleep at night, it can suppress breathing very, very powerfully. It can also turn relatively minor side effects of some sleeping pills into very dangerous ones when combined. And certainly on the topic of overdose, combining sleeping pills and alcohol can be a fatal thing. So it's very important to avoid that combination.
And then there's melatonin. From the bit I've read, it seems like one of the most misunderstood supplements. It's suitable for very specific sleep disorders, but is used for almost any sleeping issue, and its potency is not always what is claimed on the label. What do we need to know about melatonin?
Well, I talk about melatonin at length in Understanding Sleeping Pills for all the reasons that you just mentioned. Melatonin is a natural substance in the body, secreted by a little gland in the brain called the pineal gland at night. It has been found to be useful in some very specific conditions having to do with disorders of the body clock. An example of that is that it may be useful in recovery from jet lag, for instance. And there's one or two other conditions related to the body clock that it can be of help in. In contrast to that, when it's given to most folks with insomnia who don't have these one or two very specialized conditions, although initially some of its proponents were very enthusiastic about it, over time we found that it's really not beneficial. There's a report that came out in 2017 by an organization called the American Academy of Sleep Medicine on what treatments are recommended for chronic insomnia, and melatonin is not recommended on this list by the AASM. It also has its own share of side effects, which can include daytime sleepiness. So it's again an example of how things that you can buy over the counter are not necessarily very helpful for most people with insomnia.
As we near the end here, I have a fun but serious question for you. I'm going to put up thousands of billboards on highways and in cities on your behalf throughout the English-speaking world. What message do you want on those billboards?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I think an important one would be that insomnia needs to be taken seriously and that it does affect a person 24 hours a day. And the second message is it's not hopeless. And the third is there's a lot of treatment options out there, and it's very valuable to educate yourself about them and take advantage of them.
And as we wrap up, what's one thing our listeners could do today to improve their sleep tonight so they can feel and function better tomorrow?
Well, again, we sort of talked about this on the topic of, rapid expectations. And the answer is that you have to recognize that it's a process and that the beginning of that process is education. Learn, learn, learn. Be prepared when you see a caregiver, understand both the benefits and risks of treatments, but also understand the risks of not treating it.
Thank you. And where should people go to learn more about you and the resources you have available?
Well, my books, Understanding Sleeping Pills, as well as another book, Understanding Antidepressants, are both available on Amazon, both as ebooks and paperbacks. In addition, for those who would like to learn a little bit more about sleep, I also have a book, The Science of Sleep. Again, my name is Wallace Mendelson, M-E-N-D-E-L-S-O-N. And The Science of Sleep is available also on Amazon as an ebook and, in this case, a hardback. All three are designed for the purpose of putting the science and the medical aspect of sleep into language that anyone can understand, that it does not take a technical education, that it's something that any reasonable person should be able to learn from and benefit from, and hopefully not only to get some comfort from understanding what's going on, but also getting a greater understanding of what you can do about it. So looking at Amazon, my books of Wallace B. Mendelson, M-E-N-D-E-L-S-O-N. My website, which has all these books and much, much more about sleep, is at zhibit.org. So it's zhibit.org/Wallace Mendelson.
And as always, we will have the links to Dr. Mendelson's website, his books, and Facebook page on the show notes at sleepthehealthy.com. Dr. Mendelson, your life of dedication to improving people's sleep for their better health and well-being is inspiring. On behalf of our listeners, thank you for your dedication to the field of sleep and for being with us today to give us viable options to improve our sleep and well-being.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm going to recap a few key points from today's episode. One thing that struck me about this episode and episode 10 with Dr. Stephanie Silberman is that both sleep medicine experts continually point towards non-pharmaceutical interventions as the preferred route. Sleeping pills have a role to play, but doing the work to identify and correct the root cause is the preferred option. The second point is Dr. Mendelson's recommendation that you become an equal partner with your healthcare professional through continual learning. I think that medical professionals are often undertrained in sleep health and need a balanced perspective from you, their patient. The final surprise was melatonin. It seems like a very popular sleep aid for insomnia, but its application is much more limited. Please use it wisely. As always, you can find detailed show notes of the interview with Dr. Mendelson, along with all the links at sleepthehealthy.com. This concludes today's episode. You may want to also listen to episode 10 titled Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, which Dr. Mendelson referred to several times today. Thank you for keeping me company today. I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast. This podcast is not a substitute for advice from a qualified healthcare professional. The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and entertain. As we do not know your particulars, we cannot and do not provide professional or medical advice or services. We strongly encourage you to consult a healthcare professional before incorporating any ideas in this podcast. Listeners who use the information in this podcast do so at their own risk. The guests on this podcast express their own opinions, beliefs, and conclusions, which is neither supported nor opposed by the podcast and host. The podcast does not fact-check information provided.